This morning, as I continue in the message series of Jesus' parables, it's probably a familiar one to many of you, maybe all of you, that the lost son or the prodigal son, as we know it's called at times. Next Sunday will be our last in this message series of Jesus' parables, and then we'll have our church picnic, and then we'll begin a series in Hosea, which is a prophet in the Old Testament, and we'll be talking about what Hosea's experience in the Old Testament, how that speaks into our current culture and context and where we find ourselves in the 21st century. So this morning, as we look at the parable of the lost son, I want to begin, before I read that parable for you, which is probably, as I said, pretty familiar to you. There's an important part that you need to hear before I read that in terms of what chapter 15 is trying to accomplish, what Luke is doing in that specific chapter as Jesus is addressing the Pharisees and their understanding and idea of the kingdom, their understanding and idea of God and what his kingdom is all about. The values and the norms of God's kingdom. And Jesus is going to address that very specifically in chapter 15. But before we get into that, I do want to share a story with you first about a similar situation where there was a father who he lived on a ranch in Montana. And like Jesus' story here, this father had two sons as well. So this father who lived on this ranch in Montana was very successful. He was a very successful man. My story has pictures, so you can stay awake and just look at the pictures. He owned a ranch that was expansive. He was well known in the community because he had basically built this ranch from scratch. He came there with nothing. And he built a beautiful home. Isn't that a beautiful home? Wouldn't you love to live in that home? Yes. He was a very serious guy. He was like a typical cowboy of the old days. He lived a difficult life and, as I said, built this with his own bare hands. And he was very stoic, didn't smile much, didn't laugh much. He was very serious in what he did. He was very successful in what he did, and his ranch was proof of that, and people in town knew him as such and knew he was a serious guy. He had many people working for him. It was a large ranch that had lots of employees. And at this ranch, and as he was building this and being successful and people were getting to know him, they knew the kind of guy he was. He was very serious and very stoic, as I said, but he was very fair. He was very honorable, and he was respected in his community. And his hired help respected him as well. And his character was displayed in the way that he operated his ranch, and his success also was a revealing of the type of guy that he was. So he had this beautiful ranch, this wonderful home, lots of money, and a huge estate. And this same, kind of like Jesus' story, this fellow that built this ranch in Montana also had two sons. And an older son and a younger son, who both kind of helped out at the ranch. And as is kind of typical of the day, this younger son kind of felt entitled. He had lots of servants as well, or hired help at this ranch. And so he kind of got this sense of entitlement, that he was owed whatever his father had built. And so one day, he goes to his dad, and he tells his dad that he wants whatever is his. Whatever part of your huge ranch and the money that I have, I want it. Because I want to go and kind of break away from this family thing. This is the family ranch. They had a reputation in the town, and he was tired of that. He was kind of saying to his dad, I want to kind of disown our family. I'm sick of being a part of this family, having this name, everybody in town knowing me. I'm tired of all that. I want what's mine. And so this young man asks his father for his portion of his share of the ranch and everything. So his father gives that to him. He gives that his portion of that and all the assets that he would get. This young man is able to cash all that in for money, and he heads to the one place you head to in Montana when you want to spend money. He goes to Las Vegas. He heads to Las Vegas, and, I mean, if you got a ton of money in Las Vegas, what do you think you're going to do with all that? So he goes there not to plan and set up a bank account and invest and get a good job. He goes there to spend all that money. And so he starts doing that. He starts spending the money. He sets up in some apartment, but his life is really about partying, and in Las Vegas, you can find just about anything there. And so that's what he does. And so as all of you, maybe you were affected by this, 2008 happens, and the economy tanks. And all that money that he had and his lifestyle can no longer be sustained. And basically, he has gotten to the point, he has hit rock bottom, and he finds himself no longer living it up in Las Vegas, but in one of the many tent cities you can find out west. These are where homeless people live. They just purchase tents, and they set up these, what they call tent cities. And he's basically living in squalor. He's got nothing left. He's broke. There's a lot of other people that are broke. Times are hard. Maybe you experienced that in 2008, depending on what company you worked for. I know I had a friend that worked at a company for over 30 years, and 2008 happened, and that place tanked, and he, at the age of 50, had to go start a brand new career. Well, this young man is in that same situation. There's nothing out there. He can't find a job. He's basically living in this tent city, begging, trying to find something that can provide for him. And he's finally hit rock bottom. He's at that place. It's like you can't get any lower than this other than joining some kind of gang, which are plenty out west in California area and Las Vegas and those places, to just basically steal for your living because you've got nothing. So this young man starts thinking to himself. He starts coming to his senses and saying, this is crazy. I come from a family that has so much, and I'm living in a tent basically begging for food. I've come to the point where I just can't do it myself anymore. I made a huge mistake. And he's got a long road ahead of him to think about that huge mistake. Because he's headed back to the ranch in Montana. And so he's got time to think about what he's going to say to his dad when he gets back there. He's basically disowned his family and wants nothing to do with them by leaving, and told his father as much when he asked for his inheritance. He was sick of all that. So now he's thinking, I got to figure out, how do I make it up to him? What am I going to say to him? I don't need, and he's thinking to himself, I don't need everything that was entitled to me as the son. I'd be happy just to work like one of your hired hands and live out in the houses that are there for them, and I mean, I don't need all the best like I had before. Everything was provided for him. And he's thinking to himself, if I could just get my dad to let me back on the ranch, the guys that work for him eat like kings compared to what I've been subject to living in a tent city and scrounging and begging for food. And so he makes that long journey home. And he starts hitchhiking his way home. He's got no money. He's got no car. out west, they still pick up hitchhikers over here. They probably don't do it quite as much, but they still do there. And so he's making his way home. The whole time, he's rehearsing what he's going to say to his father to try and get in good graces again with him and at least be let back on the ranch and finally have some food again. So he's heading back, and one of the things that this young man's father does is at the end of the day when he's finished working, he rides up to that hill, and he kind of looks out across the ranch, and which goes into town, and he rides up there waiting for that day that his son returns home. He's been doing this every day since he left, hoping and praying that his son will come to his senses and come back home. And so he does what he has done every day, this old man, and rides to the top of the hill. He looks out over the ranch and into town, and he sees somebody starting to walk through town. And the hitchhiker, he was hitchhiking, the car dropped him off, and he starts heading back through town, kind of almost like a walk of shame as he's walking through town, because everybody knows him, and they see him coming back. And so his father kind of gets a glimpse of what looks like could be his son. And so finally, at the end of the day, this day was different than all the other days that he went to the top of that hill and saw nobody. And so the father heads down the hill, and he starts riding through town, hooting and hollering because his son is coming back. And everybody is staring at him because they know this guy. They were lucky if he ever cracked a smile, and he is riding his horse as fast as he can through town, yelling and screaming like some crazy guy, and he's running to his son. And everybody is watching this, and they can't believe what's happening. He is making an absolute fool of himself. And he reaches his son, and they embrace. Now, I didn't put that. They're cowboys. They don't want to see. You don't want to see two cowboys hugging. I mean, I at least gave them. Everybody in town saw that. I at least gave them the respect that you guys aren't going to watch that. But just know that they are hugging it out. They are embracing. This stern man, very stoic, is weeping and crying and hugging his son. Everybody in town is watching this. They can't believe what they're seeing. And finally, the son, this young son who felt entitled to everything, basically wanted to disown his family, starts trying to get out what he had rehearsed the whole trip from Las Vegas back to Montana. He had this whole thing planned out, what he was going to say to his dad to try and get in good graces again. And his dad doesn't even let him finish. He calls back up to the ranch. He's got walkie-talkie. This isn't like first century, okay? He's got a walkie-talkie. He calls back up to the ranch, and he tells them, you know that prize bull that we have? This thing is like worth thousands upon thousands of dollars. I want you to kill it. We're going to butcher it, and we're going to have a party. I want you to call everybody in town and have everybody in town come up to this party, because my son who is lost, my son who is dead, is found. He's alive again. And his son's thinking, I didn't even get a chance to say sorry. I didn't even get a chance to get out what I wanted to get out. And his father is already planning this huge party for his son's return, and they kill their prize bull, and they have enough meat to feed the entire town. I mean, it is a huge party that he is throwing for his son. So this huge party is happening, and remember, this old man, this old cowboy, had two sons. And the older son never left the ranch. And like the good son that he is, he was out in the field. He was being the responsible one, not the reckless one. And he hears all this commotion, all this music, and he comes back. And he asks one of the hired help, he says, what's going on? And he tells him, he said, your brother has come home, and your father has killed the prize bull, and he asked everybody in town to come to a party because your brother's back. Well, this older son is livid. He is angry. He never left. He stayed on that ranch and worked for his dad. And he tells his dad, he tells that hired servant, I'm not going in there. You call my father and tell him to come out here. And so they have a conversation about what's going on. And the older son starts making his case about how he was responsible. He stayed here. He did everything you asked me to. Your son goes there and is reckless. He gets all of his money, spends all of it, is destitute, and he comes back and you throw a party for him? And I've been here working my whole life, and I've got nothing. I'm like one of your hired help. And I never got anything like this from you. And so he's angry about all this. And so his father tells him very calmly, just, all that I have is yours, and you know that. But your brother was as good as dead. And he's come back, and it's like he was born again. He's alive. When that happens, we've got to celebrate. And that's where the story ends. Does that sound similar to the parable that Jesus is about to tell? We'll find out. I want to share it with you. This is a first century parable, not a 21st century parable. But the same situation is happening here. The older son, as we heard in our story, is actually the Pharisees. The father is God. The younger son is all the people that the Pharisees say don't belong in God's family. And so Jesus is going to tell them a parable about what God's heart is all about, what God's kingdom is all about. But chapter 15 of Luke, verse 1 and 2, sets the stage for what Jesus is about to do. With really these three parables, we're just going to focus on the parable of the lost son. Now, tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. Now, we know from the various parables that we've heard already, when we hear that phrase, the tax collectors and sinners, we know it's all those people that we don't hang out with, that we don't touch, that we don't get close to, that if we're going to identify somebody as being outside of God's kingdom, it's them. So Luke sets the stage. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So this is the very issue that Jesus is going to address. They see this as being a problem. This is one of the biggest gripes they have with Jesus, who says he has come and in some ways has already claimed to be God himself, but if nothing else, claims to be a prophet, yet he is hanging out with all of the wrong people. And this is one of their biggest complaints. If Jesus would just stick with the right crowd, there'd be no issues. And so Jesus tells three parables to address this issue that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law have. And these three parables are answering one question. Jesus does not, as with all the parables, Jesus does not just come out and say and ask the question. The story, the parables, were to help the hearer think about the question or think about what Jesus is addressing. If you put yourself in the father's shoes with the son, how would you have handled that? If you put yourself in the older brother's shoes when you hear the party happening and you're coming out of a hard day of work on the field at the ranch, for this son who has spent all his money in Las Vegas. How would you react? So there's one question that Jesus is asking the Pharisees. And you can think about that. We're not going to ask that question until the end. But these three parables that Jesus tells all have a similar component to them, in which we have a main character who has something. Either the sheep in the first one, the lamb, and there's 99 of them. One wanders off, and in the parable, the shepherd goes to get him. There's a lost coin. She's got 10 of them. One gets lost, goes searching for it, finds it. It's restored, and then there's rejoicing. In every single one of these, this is the scenario that is happening in all three of these parables. And the last one, the parable of the lost son, is where Jesus kind of expands what he's said in parables 1 and 2. So if you read that, it says, "Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep." Or, in verse 8, he says, "Suppose a woman has 10 silver coins." He tells two parables. And lastly, it says, Jesus continued, and he's addressing the very same issue that he addressed in parable 1 and 2, and that is, the Pharisees and teachers of the law are griping because Jesus keeps hanging out with those people. So Jesus continues, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them." Now, that little phrase doesn't maybe mean a whole lot to us, but the fact that this younger son, and most of the estate would have went to the older son, that the fact that this younger son is asking for all this before his father is dead is basically him saying, I want nothing to do with your family. He would have been rejecting his sonhood. He would have been rejecting the fact that you are my father, I am your son. By doing this very thing, he was rejecting his status in this family. So he asks for his inheritance. His father divides the property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. That distant country is simply saying he probably went to a place where the Gentiles were and would have shamed his whole family by being with Gentiles in this culture. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him." This was something you just didn't do as a Jewish man who held a pretty vast estate, who was wealthy. You didn't run anywhere, ever, let alone do what he did. He fell on him, and he kissed him, and he embraced him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, as though he didn't even hear what his son said, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he is found." So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of his servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back, safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends." Period found is not the way that this story goes. The older brother became angry. He refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf." He doesn't address him as father, and he says, "When this son of yours," not "when my brother comes home," but "this son of yours comes home." And he kind of elaborates a little bit on this reckless living. He's kind of, I guess, taking his own liberties here and speculating what his younger brother may have or may not have done, and spending his money and squandering his property with prostitutes and who knows what else. And of course, the implication being, I, the good son, have always been here. And yet he compares himself to one of the slaves. And so his father answers him, "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." That's where the "found" should have been. "He was lost and is found." And again, Jesus ends his story there. So what is the point of that story? What is Jesus trying to communicate with this parable, knowing what we know about chapter 15, verse 1 and 2, and the Pharisees' big issue with Jesus? What we see happening in this story is a positive response coming to his senses in a way of his life not going down the road he knows it should have gone down. The implication here that Jesus is saying is one of repentance. A positive response to the message that Jesus has come to share. Even a positive response from those people that you say are outside of God's kingdom, even their positive response necessitates the fact that those who are lost, and you couldn't get more lost than the tax collectors and sinners. You couldn't get more lost than this young guy who's living it up in Las Vegas. When you respond positively to the message that Jesus is coming to preach, to the gospel that is good news to the lame and to the sick and to the poor and the needy, Jesus says elsewhere in Luke. A positive response of the lost means we need to celebrate. And what this means in Jesus' day is that I will walk into his home, Zacchaeus' home, one of these tax collectors, and I'll sit down at the table beside him and we'll break bread together. You just didn't do that in Jesus' day. It was as though you're condoning their life and what they stand for by sitting down and eating with them at that table. It's like you didn't care that your son takes all of his money and squanders it in Las Vegas and comes back, and it's as if you don't care all that he did to you. And you just receive him as a son again and make him like he was back on the ranch. Jesus is trying to help these guys see that it doesn't matter who you are in this grand scheme of God's plan of redemption. You can be as lost can be. But when you start making that journey back home and you head out of Las Vegas and start making that long walk home to that ranch back in Montana, when you respond positively to this message, this is the kind of rejoicing that happens. We hear in the other parables in heaven, in God's realm, this is what is taking place. Even the angels are rejoicing. This is what the Pharisees and teachers of the laws don't get. They just don't understand how expansive God's grace is. And this is revealing to us as well that Jesus is making this unmistakable and telling this unmistakable message through these parables that the Pharisees have completely missed what God is all about. What they think God is all about in reality is the exact opposite of what God is all about. What we have seen through all these parables, and especially in this one, is what the heart of God is really about. And the heart of God, because in Jesus' parable, that father is the image of God. And he goes running to embrace his son because he was dead and he's alive again. Anyone who is returning back to God, that is the kind of reception they receive. If I was that old man who had built that ranch by my bare hands, and my son did what he did to me, feeling entitled, doing all that, I might have a hard time embracing that son again. There might be some stipulations to getting back in to my good graces. Maybe you've experienced that. That's not God's response to those who are dead and come alive again. This is the response that God has. You can be as lost as anyone on this planet. And when you turn from that life and start making that long walk back, God comes to you before you even get to him and embraces you. See, that's what the Pharisees didn't get. It's not that their sin didn't matter. It's that they recognized that and they are embracing this message that Jesus has, that this all-encompassing, expansive grace that God has, not just for the Jews, as the book that Luke writes later called Acts shows, when God's grace even includes the Gentiles. They just were missing it completely. And Jesus, through all these parables, and this one especially, is telling the Pharisees, the values and norms that you have lived your life with and you are telling all these people about are in contradiction to the values and norms of God. And Jesus came to tell them that. So it doesn't matter how lost you think you are, God will catch up with you before you even get back to him when you make that long walk back. And if you've ever been one of those lost souls, son or daughter, maybe you know what that feels like. I know I do. To experience that embrace that God has. And I know that I experienced that with my own parents. So maybe you are still having one of those lost son or daughters. This is the response we should have when they're found again. And this is the reality of the kingdom of God, that God comes running after them before they even get back. And sometimes that is difficult. Sometimes that's hard. I know a young lady who didn't have the greatest life growing up. Her father wasn't the greatest. And her father became a believer and put his faith and trust in Jesus. And she had a really hard time being happy and kind of rejoicing like this father because of the way her father was. Sometimes it's not easy. Yet we hear the father at the end of this story say, "Everything I have is yours." This is almost like the command. When someone who is dead is alive again, we've got to celebrate. Maybe you've struggled with that in your life, where somebody who has wronged you or done something comes to Jesus and you have a hard time rejoicing over that fact. Jesus is challenging us to rejoice like the Father rejoices when that son or daughter or that person comes to know Him. Jesus ends His story with the question. We can put ourselves in each of these people's shoes. How would I respond if that son or daughter comes back to me, or that person comes back to me after they've wronged me in some way? How would I respond as that young person, that maybe that was you, as I said? I can identify certainly with that young man that was at rock bottom and came back. And the other thing that Jesus is asking these Pharisees, the one question He has for them, from chapter 15, verse 1 and 2, is, will you, Pharisees, rejoice and have table fellowship with these lost sinners in God's kingdom? Now we know Jesus says God's kingdom is at hand because He was there. And so Jesus was already having table fellowship with these lost people. And the Pharisees were not. But the reality is, when you are part of God's kingdom and God calls you son and daughter, even these lost sinners and tax collectors, even those Gentiles, are now sons and daughters of God. Are you willing to sit down at the table with them? If you read Acts, Peter was faced with that same scenario. Was I willing to embrace the expansiveness of God's grace and sit down and eat with Simon the Tanner, a Gentile who worked with dead animals, as one of these lost ones that are part of God's kingdom? Are we willing to have table fellowship? Now, we don't call them tax collectors and sinners necessarily, but we, in our own culture, have our little pet sins that are worse than other sins. And sometimes maybe we think unforgivable in some ways. And we kind of have a pecking order of which sins I'm willing to forgive and who I'm willing to sit down with, talk to, who I'm willing to be friends with, who I'm willing to rub shoulders with, depending on what sin they have. Maybe it's not tax collectors today. Maybe it still is, I don't know. But there are some in our culture, and they're usually the hot button issues that we have as the church. And Jesus is asking us the same question. Are we willing to have table fellowship with them? See, Jesus' kingdom oftentimes looks different than the way we would have created it. I would have had a hard time embracing that son coming back. I would have had a hard time not being angry like the older son was. I would have struggled with all that, yet this is the heart of God. He's revealed to us the norms and the values of His kingdom. And as His church, we're to have those norms and values as well. Now that doesn't mean we simply say, well, everything's okay, who cares? You've missed the point then of people embracing the message that Jesus brought, that indeed we do need saving from ourselves in a lot of ways. And that indeed all of us have that sin that needs to be forgiven. But when we embrace that message that Jesus has come to give us life, and to give us life more abundantly, as lost as we are, God embraces us as a son or a daughter. And we as a church need to embrace those who have given their lives to Jesus in that way as well. And even embrace our own sons and daughters who are walking away, going down a road we know doesn't lead to where they think it leads. But when they return, will we embrace them as God embraces us? See, that's the message that Jesus gives in these parables. The message of God's kingdom and what it looks like. That God's grace is bigger than our lostness. And that Jesus' message of this kingdom includes even maybe some of those people we think are lost forever. Jesus challenges us today as he challenges those Pharisees and tax collectors regarding who we will have table fellowship with. And it's important for us as a church who are representing God's heart, his norms, and his values to be reminded about that as we face a world that we know is growing further and further away from the norms and the values that maybe we hold and possess as followers of Jesus. Yet we're called to still have the same heart that God has for the world he created and the world he will redeem. Let's pray. God, thank you for your goodness. Thank you for your grace, that your grace is willing to even embrace a lost son such as myself and maybe someone else in here, Lord, that your grace is willing to even come out and meet us before we even get back. God, help us to be able to, as your church, live the way Jesus has called us to live and be challenged as he challenged the Pharisees and teachers of the law. Lord God, to be able to see those who are lost, that your kingdom is for them as well. God, help us to love like Jesus loved. Help us to live the way Jesus has called us to live. We pray it in his name. Amen.